Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
This edition of The Curator was first broadcast on the 27th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. The Curator, in association with Rolex. Hello and welcome to The Curator with me, Gillian DeBias. Over the next 60 minutes, I'll be playing you my pick of the very best interviews and reports from the past week here on Monocle 24 with highlights from our studios at Midori House. On this week's programme, we take a look at the political turmoil in France.
The biggest pledge that he'd given as a presidential candidate was that he would reduce unemployment. He has singularly, consistently failed to do that since unemployment has risen every quarter since he's been president.
Plus, superstar of philosophy Simon Critchley tells us about his latest book, Memory Theatre.
It feels incredibly painfully intimate. And there's some things in there in a kind of code which I'd rather people didn't read.
And we meet Tim Key, a comedian who truly pushes the boundaries of what can be done in the world of stand-up.
You know, you can sort of really lay into someone, I find, so long as people are laughing and enjoying it and the person knows that it's a joke, if there's a glint in your eye, then in a way, the more brutal the better. It can be kind of quite spectacular.
All that and plenty more coming up in the next hour right here on The Curator with me, Gillian DeBias. Over the course of this week, our current affairs shows took a look at the state of France. The topics were economy, immigration, culture, the language, and also the ongoing political turmoil. Just last week, Prime Minister Manuel Valls survived a confidence vote on his newly reshuffled government. However, he did not obtain an absolute majority, meaning that any future attempts to rein in public spending or enact reforms risk being held hostage by rebel leftists. At the same time, the popularity of French President François Hollande has hit the record low of 13%. Probably not helpful, then, that a week ago, former President Nicolas Sarkozy announced his political comeback. He's going to seek re-election as head of the opposition UMP party. To discuss this and the course French politics is taking, Tag Enright and Georgina Godwin were joined by Bénédicte Pavieux, London correspondent for France 24 News Network.
2.5 years into a 5-year mandate for the president, we know he's there, as Americans say, for the duration. So barring him choosing to step down, President Hollande, despite beating all records of unpopularity in a Fifth Republic, he's down to 13% only. It is catastrophic. He's not trusted. French people, indeed his own socialist party, people who voted for him, do not believe that he is the person with the vision, with the policy, with the government to actually change, turn around the economic fortunes of France. It is worrying because one of his biggest pledges, the biggest pledge that he'd given as a presidential candidate, was that he would reduce unemployment. He has singularly, consistently failed to do that since unemployment has risen every quarter since he's been president. It's now up to more than 10%, and that's over 3 million unemployed, which is deeply worrying. And we've got zero growth. We've got still a bloated public sector. So this is very worrying. And he's on his fourth government in 2.5 years. So you would think that the people to benefit from this would be the Conservatives and the right wing. But you would be wrong, because you obviously know that there is huge infighting. So the one person who is benefiting from the infighting of the right and the unpopularity of the governing left is actually Marine Le Pen of the Front National.
And now the PM is also not popular at all. Tell us about this.
Well, let's not be too unfair. First, let's say he's already on his second government, but he's only been 4 months in the job. Manuel Valls is the man you're referring to. He's got a better polling rate than the president, but you might say that's not difficult. But he has lost about 13 points just over the last 2 months, which is not good. And indeed, in your introduction, you both pointed out the fact that the motion of confidence that was voted in the French Parliament had shrunk, and that is worrying. Let's remember why that first government of Manuel Valls fell. That is because imagine you are in Britain, you are in Italy, you are in Turkey, you are wherever you want in the world, but okay, let's say a democracy, and you have a government and your economic minister criticises the Prime Minister and the President's economic policy. Ouch. So Arnaud Montebourg was the man in question, had to go. So the President not just has bad poll ratings, doesn't just have rising unemployment, but he also has a problem because he has a dissident wing in his own socialist party.
I mean, funny you talk about criticising economic policy. I mean, I remember the election which brought Hollande to power. He thumbed his nose at the austerity policies being pursued by so many governments and being espoused by the European Commission. Is there any sense amongst the French public that, you know, we voted for this, he was promising the undeliverable, and here it is, it hasn't been delivered?
Well, people who voted for him, I think it was very much an anti-Sarkozy vote. In the same way that in 1981, there was an anti-Giscard d'Estaing, the then Conservative president, vote. I once described Mr. Sarkozy as being like Marmite. For people who don't know around the world what Marmite is like, you love it or you hate it. It's a yeast paste, but you are not
that's
indifferent
awful.
To it. Well, that's your opinion. I couldn't possibly comment. Not my favourite thing in the world. But anyway, so it is extraordinary that, and as if French politics wasn't exciting enough, we have a political comeback, as you also mentioned very ably in your introduction, of the ex-president, Nicolas Sarkozy, and who people have either very positive reactions to. He's the potential, at the moment, reluctant saviour. He, for 40 minutes on French television, was at pains to underline that he didn't have a choice to come back politically. He has to, because he has to give this back to France. But of course, when you look at poll ratings, half the people, French people, think he shouldn't bother. So it really is a very extraordinary time. And what we're seeing a French president, as I said, who is very unpopular, who did a two-hour press conference, beginning with a 45-minute statement, mostly on foreign policy, by the way, on Thursday, and who suddenly, having been part of the melee and on his fourth government in 2.5 years, with all these bad economic news and dissidents within his own party, reduced majority, etc., etc., was also, he was at lengths to point out that he is the president and therefore, you know, he has this vision for foreign policy. And he has been bolder on his foreign policy, i.e. sending French troops to Mali, i.e. being the first Western ally of the United States to not only announce on Thursday in this press conference that France would took the threat of ISIS around the world extremely seriously. It's not just a threat for France, with, like Britain, returning jihadis, but it's a threat globally. And as a UN Security Council permanent seat member, it must do something about it. But, you know, we're all now looking at 2017. Whoops, we're in 2014. So what is needed now is changing the economic policies, rebuilding the trust and giving some hope to French people today.
Bénédicte Pavillot, London correspondent for France 24 News Network, speaking to Tag Enright and Georgina Godwin on Monday's edition of The Globalist. You're listening to The Curator on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias. Earlier this week, Ed Miliband, the leader of the opposition here in the UK, spoke to the Labour Party conference for the last time before next May's general election, effectively making his pitch to be Prime Minister. It did not go all that well.
Together says it's not just a powerful few at the top whose voices should be heard, it's the voice of everyone. Together says we just can't succeed as a country with the talents of a few. We've got to use the talents of all. Together says that we can't have some people playing rules. Everybody's got to play under the same rules. And Together says that we have a duty to look after each other when times are hard. Together, the way we restore faith in the future. Together, a different idea for Britain.
Miliband was boring, vacuous, forgot to mention the budget deficit, and spent a bewildering quantity of time recalling a man called Gareth who he'd met in a park. His big selling point was supposed to be that he'd spoken without notes. But so what? Why has memory become more prized than oratory? David Kuznet was President Bill Clinton's chief speechwriter from 1992 to 1994. He's now the senior writer at the Podesta Group, and he spoke to Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson on Wednesday's edition of the Monocle Daily.
Well, I think it's good to be seen as speaking spontaneously and from the heart, as Bill Clinton is often does. But I think when some kind of technique, whether it's speaking without notes or speaking from memory or whatever, when that overshadows what you're saying, then the technique isn't a good one. Any political leader wants to have their message be what people are listening for, not their technique.
Why, therefore, would you think that someone like Ed Miliband would want to do it without notes? Because surely if this is indeed your job interview to become the next leader of a country, you want to look your best. And he didn't sound confident. I mean, I was just listening to what he was saying. I put the words weak, thin and whiny and lacking in confidence. Do you think this was something that Ed Miliband wasn't entirely comfortable in doing?
I don't know the history of how he came about using that technique and then publicizing the fact that he was using it. You would know better than I, but I remember reading some time ago that David Cameron tried, did the same thing at a Conservative Party conference, and maybe there's some kind of competition there.
David, you've worked with the likes of Bill Clinton, who I think everybody acknowledges was thrilling to watch in so many ways and thrilling to listen to. Do you ever get given Ed Miliband's to deal with?
I think we're that this discussion is probably being very unfair to Ed Miliband. I read.
Did you listen to the speech?
I listened to some of the speech. I read some of the accounts of it, and it seems to me that that he's saying what a progressive political leader in the year 2014 would say in an advanced country like Britain or the United States or elsewhere. He's making a lot of the same points that President Clinton made in the 90s and President Obama is making now. I think it's unfortunate that this technique is overshadowing what he was saying. It seemed to me that what he was saying made sense and it was very reasonable points to be making.
But style is obviously important to a political communicator, rather, as well as content. Bill Clinton certainly had the style. President Barack Obama very much has the style. But is it, and again, looking at it from a speechwriter's point of view, can you take an Ed Miliband and turn him into a Bill Clinton, or is it something you just have to be born with?
Bill Clinton has been in the public eye. He's been running for office, holding office, been a former president since 1970, literally since 1974 when he ran for Congress. So it's about 40 years. So Ed Miliband is at a very different stage in his career from where Bill Clinton is now. Bill Clinton's first speech at a Democratic National Convention was in 1988. And by Clinton's own admission, that went terribly. That was when he nominated Michael Dukakis for president, and he made the opposite mistake. He read verbatim a speech that Dukakis' staff had prepared for him. It did not go over well, and his major applause line was when he said at the end, "And so in closing," and that was the first time that the audience applauded. So Bill Clinton's national debut was not an auspicious one. So you really can't compare someone who left office in the year 2001 with someone who will be running for national office for the first time next year.
That was David Kuznet from Washington speaking to Monocle's Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. You're with the curator on Monocle 24. We take a short break now, and when we're back, we continue with aviation news.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual Watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual Watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Curator, and I'm Gillian DeBias. In recent weeks, the U.S. Department of Transportation has made headlines over what some call unnecessary meddling in the business of airlines. International Air Transport Association chief Tony Tyler is taking the regulatory body to task over its moves to force airlines to better explain their fares to consumers, arguing that no other industry is regulated in such a way. He's also said that the DOT should not prohibit airlines from allowing in-flight telephone calls, especially if there are no safety concerns associated with them. This all falls on the heels of a DOT decision earlier this month that blocked Norwegian Air's current attempts at expanding its operations to North America. This is what Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé discussed with Tristan McAllister, our transport editor.
There's been a massive amount of deregulation in the airline industry in the past two, three decades, especially with the coming of the EU and sort of stronger ties between countries and open skies agreements. What we've seen is regulatory authorities essentially step back in terms of what airlines can charge passengers for fares, in terms of what is mandated as essential for ticket prices. So this now from IATA and Tony Tyler, of course, we should say too that they lobby on behalf sometimes of the airlines. Mm. But still, the idea is that regulatory bodies, you mentioned France saying that Air France is not going to proceed with its low-cost ambitions. Regulatory bodies are stepping in and saying, we want to have more say in what airlines are doing, even though we tend to be in an era of deregulation.
Mm. Let's jump to Norwegian because it picks up on the whole notion of low cost. This has been, it's been a high profile story on so many levels in the news bulletin. We were, of course, hearing about the issues with the 787. Here was an airline that was supposed to get at 787s. You've had a CEO who's really come out swinging at them. They finally get these planes into the air. There's a whole registry issue as to are these planes Norwegian, but at least registered in Ireland. And then you, I guess, have Norwegians in the cockpit. But then you've got sort of lovely Thai ladies and boys, and maybe even lady boys, working the trolleys in the aisle. But this is of course, what the DOT has been, and I guess other airlines as well, have been also upset with it. It's just, of course, it's a completely new way of being savvy and trying to run a long-haul carrier. And there's so many moving parts to it. It's clearly getting up the nose of a number of regulatory bodies. What happens there, do you think?
Well, what happens is that we're in uncharted territory, and that's what you're seeing. I think, again, we're talking about this theme of what a lot of people call overreach. In the case of Norwegian, what we saw with the United States Department of Transportation was essentially an application by Norwegian to start flying flights to the U.S. under a different operating certificate, which was based in Ireland, not Norway, which is where the company, of course, originated. What happened in the United States was this overwhelming cry from airlines, from lobbying authorities saying, you cannot allow this to happen because they're skirting labor laws, because they're essentially working to undercut in an unfair way not only U.S. carriers but foreign carriers as well. The DOT didn't deny the certificate, but they just said, we're going to put off the decision. Mm. And conveniently, they're putting it off till the elections happen.
Now, but I imagine, though, you know, if this goes ahead, I guess it's a precedent issue as well, because it opens up for everybody to completely sort of reinvent not just where they're going to register aircraft, but how they crew these planes.
Yeah, that's the big debate. And, you know, you mentioned Thailand, you mentioned Southeast Asia, of course, big boom in travel there. Lots of sort of rising talent in terms of service, people who know what they're doing. Of course, you know, labor for a lot of these airlines could be, maybe should be worried, because these people can provide in the marketplace what everyone else can, but for far lower costs, and it's very appealing to airline.
Airbus's A320neo, a slightly jazzed up, more fuel efficient version of the workhorse of many short haul carriers, was supposed to have taken to the skies this morning. Did it?
As far as I saw, it hasn't yet. But I think with this neo,
supposed to be piloted by Air France pilots. Maybe.
Yeah, well, supposed to, perhaps. I mean, it's happening in France, so we don't know. But it won't be a game changer. But what it will do is help airlines save money and just cram more seats into the back of the airplane.
Monocle's transport editor, Tristan McAllister, speaking to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. You're with The Curator, our weekly highlight show here on Monocle 24, and I'm Gillian Tobias. Tim Key is a man who approaches comedy and perhaps life from a slightly different angle to most. You may recognize him from his turn on the big screen as Alan Partridge's sidekick in the recent Alpha Papa film. But it's his widely ambitious and creative live stand-up shows that are really making waves. Where many comedians are content to either detail the minute observations of their daily life, embark on misanthropic flights of fancy, or simply bemoan exactly how middle class they've become, Tim Key truly pushes the boundaries of what can be done in the world of stand-up comedy. With a new show on tour called Single White Slut that takes in video, dance, poetry, some excruciating audience participation and no small quantities of alcohol, Tim came into the Monocle studios with nothing but his collection of poetry on a selection of pornographic playing cards for a sit-down with Monocle's Paul Noble.
Tim Key, yeah. Welcome into the Monocle studios.
Oh, thank you.
I saw your show in Edinburgh a few weeks ago. Oh. I absolutely loved it. We have to start with just the moment you come in, because it's unexpected. I walked in and there you were, sitting on a bed,
yep,
in a denim onesie, huge flowing beard, flicking playing cards around like a man waiting on death row.
Yeah.
It was quite an unsettling opening to a show.
Was it? Well, the aim of that is to put people at ease.
Right.
So that worked.
Well, that worked.
Actually, it's mainly to put myself at ease. The last three shows that I've done, I've started on stage because the alternative is...
The big walkout.
I don't like it. The big walkout's okay, because then at least you sort of, you know, you hear people's manic applause.
Mm.
It's the bit before that where you're just sort of pacing up and down and sort of shitting everywhere.
Yeah.
Like a racehorse. I don't really like that. And so being on stage just demystifies everything and... sitting on the bed, I can sort of see the audience come in and not sort of imagine, you know, 300 demons and devils. I can just see that they're sort of people who look like me with beards like I've got.
So you're transferring all your fear and nervous energy onto the audience who are walking past you, not quite knowing, has the show started? Am I part of it? He's raising an eyebrow at me.
Yeah, I guess that is what I'm doing. I mean, it was genuinely self-preservation was how it started, but... I've never really sort of thought what audiences think. I suppose, what's it like being an audience member?
There's just a deep fear that you're going to get pulled up on stage and made to sit on a bed.
Oh, I would never do that. I do that.
I know you do that.
Yeah, that's the main part of the show. Yeah. No, but I don't mean to unsettle you, Paul.
It didn't unsettle me, but it certainly put a sort of air of tension in the air.
Yeah.
And it feels very... crafted in particular. You're not wandering around with the mic, whipping the cable around you, doing observations. It's a very crafted show with elements of dance and choreography, film, a lot of sound design. How much effort do you put into crafting these shows?
I mean, obviously there's some effort goes in. I mean, I would like to say, you know, I'd like to be one of those guys who kind of can ace an exam and say, nah, not really, just sort of got lucky. But no, it's not really like that. I kind of spend quite a lot of time writing... And then I do quite a lot of getting it ready.
Is this on your own?
Or
is this...
No. I do it with an audience.
Right.
So I tend to, with that show, I guess I started doing it maybe a year or two ago, I guess. The way I did it was I had an idea. That's the sort of most important thing, I think. There's a little idea. And then because of the idea, I knew I needed to have a bed. So I got a bed.
Mm-hmm.
And then wrote loads of stuff that was to do with beds. And gradually... built it up into, so I had lots of stuff. And then, yeah, what you're talking about, I suppose, kind of working out how it all fits together, that's a mixture of trying really hard to make it fit together and then having a moment where suddenly something just fits together and you kind of get lucky and a bit now works that didn't before. So I think I work really hard trying to make it work, and then I think in the end it does work, but I don't know how much the two things are related.
Well, the effect is very... slow and hypnotic, and you really had the audience exactly where you wanted them. Suddenly you're appearing up in the rafters 10 rows back, you're on a bed, you're not on the bed anymore. I was wondering how important is it for you to have control of the audience, and you know, if you have suddenly hecklers or people trying to butt into the show.
Yeah, I think it's healthy that you're the main one just for that hour. If someone else is sort of the main person, then something's gone a bit wrong. But there's room, you know, you can have a show where, you know, something can happen and there can be, you know, sort of characters floating around in the room who are kind of part of the show. And I think what you say is right. It just, the important thing is that you are in control. So if you've got some guy who's just, you know, gone mental and let himself down and sort of started crying because he couldn't say what he needed to say, then that's fine, so long as the audience, I think it's important that the audience are watching thinking he's controlling all this. Even if there's a heckler, it doesn't matter. As long as the audience are watching and thinking he's enjoying having that guy there, then it's fine. The moment where the audience are thinking, oh dear, problems, then the show will rapidly descend into a survival situation. You know, you can sort of really lay into someone, I find. And so long as people are laughing and enjoying it and the person knows that it's a joke, if there's a glint in your eye, then in a way, the more brutal, the better. It can be kind of quite spectacular.
Looking at your presence on Twitter, you've got Tim Key Person and Tim Key Poet. And there seems, during the show, to be a tension between Tim Key, who is a bloke in front of us, who we recognise as, you know, a man of English origin. Mm. And then there's a Tim Key character, which is a sort of very sharp, and there's almost a sort of Brechtian divide where you can cross that line. Mm. And I was wondering where, clearly you've got a theatre, an interest in theatre, and there is a lot of drama takes place in the show.
Brecht. Why is he asking about Brecht? Trying to promote my show. Now, the guy's saying, Brecht wants to know about this Brechtian schism between my actual me and... It was kind of a character, I think. I mean, I wore an ill-fitting suit covered in lager. Brecht, I remember from theatre studies. And we had to... What was it? There was Stanislavski. The actor prepares, and then Edward Gordon Craig, Uber Marionettes, and then Brecht was doing stuff where he'd put stuff up. It'd say what he was going to do with sidebars. There are bits where it goes off in sort of that direction of this kind of. There's a guy there who's kind of obscene and quite alarming and menacing, and someone that you wouldn't necessarily want you to align yourself with. And then it also in the mix, like you say, you can just sort of chat away with someone in a kind of advanced version of yourself. I mean, I talk to, like you say, I kind of invite people up and we sort of chat on the bed. And the only real difference is that I'm sort of more confident than in real life. That having that wing to it, the kind of a little bit more of me in it, does allow you to sort of be able to do slightly different things. You can do slightly more interesting things. I think you can talk about stuff which is slightly more unacceptable and sell it in a slightly more charming way, where people kind of think, I don't know, people can sort of take it, enjoy it, laugh at it, and then a few seconds later think, oh, hang on, that was horrible. But no, I've never had a moment where I've felt, oh, shouldn't have done that.
That was comedian Tim Key with Monocle's Paul Noble, and as you just heard, his show Single White Slut is currently touring. Still to come on this episode of The Curator, we ask how much we should be thinking about beauty when judging our built environment. We'll also meet superstar of philosophy, Simon Critchley. Stay tuned.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to The Curator, our programme gathering up the best bits from the past week here on Monocle 24. I'm Gillian Tobias. Beauty is often something we strive for in cities, though in city speak it's almost always called beautification. But aesthetics are always subjective. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So is that how we should be judging our built environment? Maybe not, says Rory Hyde, curator of contemporary architecture and urbanism at the V&A. Perhaps the best cities are not ones obsessed with beauty, but with ambition. Rory joins Andrew Tuck for this week's Urbanist.
Of course, taste is subjective and beauty comes down to taste ultimately. But when it comes to cities, when it comes to architecture, I think there are some sort of broader principles which we can lean back on. I mean, very few people would argue with good quality of light, with green trees, with parks, with, you know, good proportion buildings, with, I don't know, good orientation, social spaces, public spaces, and all those things kind of add up to some idea of beauty. But and I guess if you get all of those things right, then what your architecture looks like or what your actual style of building is perhaps doesn't matter. So I would say there's some bigger themes there which add up to beauty. But
do you think there's a challenge there around the idea of modernity? Because it's when we look at the cities that people typically say they think of as beautiful, they may have some of the elements you're talking about, you know, good green space, for example, you know, Stockholm. But actually, the cities that people gravitate to, you know, is Venice always comes at top of the list for people when they think of a beautiful city. But it completely lacks modernity. It's about, you know, the past. Is it hard to create a modern, beautiful city?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And of course, every architect in the 20th century had a crack at that. I mean, Le Corbusier's Ville Radieuse is somehow trying to be, you know, modern city set within a park. But evidently, one of the greatest failures of modernity was this attempt to marry modern architecture with the beautiful old city. I mean, he proposed demolishing Paris. So that was his kind of answer to, you know, Paris's problem with beauty, as you say. Hopefully it's a taste thing, and hopefully it's a time thing, and hopefully some of the cities which we've built in the 20th century, I'm thinking of, you know, Chicago or New York, have their own kind of beauty which is different to that of Paris or Venice.
And New York is a great example. I'm always struck when we have the opportunity to go to New York to see our team out there in New York. When you're in Manhattan, the way that light reflects off of, you know, the skyscrapers, the sense of light when you're on the pavement, even the small pocket gardens at the base of skyscrapers, there's a kind of a tough beauty, but, you know, beauty nevertheless.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, New York, you would say, is a fairly aggressive city. It's a tough city. It's a city that doesn't let you go. It's kind of grabs hold of you. That's not something that we normally think of as beautiful, but certainly it's hard to argue with walking down Madison Avenue.
Now, there's also this notion of beautification. Lots of city mayors, they look at their cities and think, okay, this ain't the prettiest place, but with a few more trees or with some bike lanes or a pond or something, we can make this place look better. Do you think that is something that's viable or that should be done? Is beautification, again, a helpful idea?
Well, first of all, beautification, the word itself, is not a very beautiful word. So I think you're already off on the wrong foot. Again, these things are, you know, beautiful things in and of themselves. We love trees. We love bike lanes. We love cafe tables. We love that sort of European sensibility, which I think is captured in that word beautification. But it's somehow flattening. It's somehow monocultural. It somehow becomes to the same. It somehow flattens the things which we like about cities, which are, you know, difference, which are culture, which are multicultural. You know, the pockets of extreme expression in one direction or another. I think that the trouble with beautification when it's, I guess, rolled out en masse is that it turns the city into a retirement village.
And one of the big proponents of this kind of version of how a city looks is, you know, Jan Gehl. And I think what's interesting, although we of course admire many of the things he does, is that every city now looks at his version of what a city should be like. And they call it, you know, I think it's another not very easy word, but Copenhagenization. This idea that you take the values of a small city like Copenhagen and you apply them to, say, a Sydney. And it's all great, but, you know, Sydney's hilly. It's not perhaps, you know, the best place for cycle paths. But also, it's just this version, that the same version of the city being repeated, whether it's in Manhattan or London or Sydney. And this flattening of experience you talk about, do you think that in a way we're losing the grit and the sexiness and the energy that actually, even the traffic that sometimes makes a city exciting?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what an incredible career that Jan Gehl's managed to have. I mean, touring the world, urban principles of his home city to every city around the world. I mean, it's a credible achievement. But as you say, I think cities need to develop and encourage their own cultures, their own qualities to sort of push them further in that direction. And there's some new cities which I think we can learn from, maybe here in Europe or in the West, where, you know, cities like Dubai or cities like Shanghai or Shenzhen, which have a different understanding of speed, of urban experience, of architecture, which is somehow, yes, it's leaning on, again, this idea of modernity, which we're familiar with, but it seems unconcerned with the past in a way that I think is liberating.
Okay, some quite radical ideas here. You're certainly shaking things up with the suggestion that maybe Dubai is potentially the modern beautiful city, or the city that's beautified or created something interesting that's different from elsewhere in the world. Let me challenge you on that. Well, most people would say you're wrong. Most people would say that they find these cities slightly unplanned, slightly, you know, without heart, slightly without serendipity, slightly without the accidents of architecture that happen over generations because they're thrown up so quickly. But explain to me why you challenged me on this.
I'll grab hold of that one. So I would agree with, first of all, those points. I think that's right. I think that the climate of Dubai forces you into a mall somehow. You need to kind of air condition the public spaces, and that's problematic. So the serendipity is already crossed out there. Of course, it has, you know, troubling, very troubling labor conditions, and they should never be ignored in a conversation like this. But equally, I think there's some encouraging steps towards making it a real urban place. The new metro as a public transportation system is a really exciting step for a place which we believe to be completely wedded to oil and to cars. We're seeing, really encouraging, forms of governance and experiments there, which is about, a total participation and perhaps rolling out some of those rights to other participants there. So and again, Shenzhen is it's the factory of the world, and this idea of Shenzhen speed I find really compelling, where how do you form an idea of urban coherence when things change so quickly, and that's something new, and that's something that I think we ought to learn from rather than dismiss too quickly.
That was Rory Hyde, Curator of Contemporary Architecture and Urbanism at the V&A, speaking to Monocle's Andrew Tuck. Simon Critchley has published no fewer than 12 books in the last 14 years. He's Professor of Philosophy at the New School in New York and prompts the kind of accolades usually reserved for a boy band. He is a superstar of philosophy, no less. Simon now has a new book out, and it's called Memory Theatre, and Emma Nelson interviewed him about his new release.
The book is a kind of fictional thing, but it relates to someone I actually knew called Michel Ard, who was a French philosopher that died about 15 years ago. And the story is about a series of boxes that turn up in my office at the University of Essex.
Which did happen.
Yeah, not quite in the way I tell it, but let's say it happened. And then in these boxes, I go through basically the contents of this philosopher's life, sifting through, and I describe, and I find these texts, and then I find these, what I think are astrological charts. Michel was an astrologer. That was his great passion. And then I find these, what I call these memory maps, which seem to be maps of the lives of philosophers who've died. Then I find these maps of philosophers who are still living. And one of them is my own, which then predicts my future demise. And then I begin to kind of plan out that structure. And I find this text by Michel on the art of memory. This whole weird book is a kind of conceit about memory systems, memory theatres. And then I begin to have hallucinations and move to the Netherlands.
Well, this is one of the things. It starts off as a book where you're unpicking and unpacking these boxes, and you start mm-hmm. talking about memory and what's called the theatre of memory and the idea mm-hmm. of total recall. And I'm thinking, okay, this is a book about this author's discovery of what's happened in his office. But then suddenly, when you get to the map of your astrological chart, mm-hmm. I think you describe it as it feels like your destiny's just been mapped out for you.
Yeah.
And then suddenly on the next page, you've moved to the Netherlands almost to fulfill the promise of what's on the piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to put your life in order.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, did you really do that? Because I got rather confused. I got rather sort of mystified by what was actually happening in this tale.
Oh, it's not an accurate memoir. It's a life which I really hope doesn't happen to me.
Did you really go to the Netherlands and prepare for your death?
No.
Right.
Well, in a way I did. I do go to the Netherlands regularly, and it always feels that I die in a different way every time I go there. So in a way I did. And the empirical research for the book is incredibly accurate. So everything I say is true, but it's not exactly true in the way in which I say it. So I end up in the Netherlands building this weird memory theatre, which is going to contain the sum of the entirety of my knowledge, my life, and everything that I know in this backyard of this house in Den Bosch in the Netherlands. And I then anticipate the moment of my death. And then I repeat and reenact this act of memory over weeks and months. And then I do not die.
What happens then?
And then things get even weirder. Then I start to write about it in the persona of the narrator in the story, who then conceives of another weirder memory theatre, which is going to be set on an island and where the whole of the universe would be repeated. So the text is a kind of experiment in kind of delusion, right? In forms of psychotic delusion. And It's a description of a universe without love for me.
It's a lonely place when you're trying to find yourself through your memory.
So it's what I really do not want to happen in my life. So it's a kind of alternative negative memoir in a strange way, insofar as it's a memoir.
It is all packed into what, no fewer than just under 80 pages. You've managed to take us on an enormously complicated journey in that time. What was it that made you embark upon this course of writing? Because it's not a book on philosophy, although there are elements where you start talking about philosophy.
Yeah.
It's not a memoir. It's not a true account of what happened, but it's not a novel.
No, it's a kind of mixed form, I guess. And, you know, I've been collaborating with writers over the years, and I've been experimenting with different forms over the years. And I wrote a book with my wife about Shakespeare, and this book appeared, as it were, at the end of that. So this act of, you know, joint writing, which was a real act of love, this thing began to pop out, and it took about 3 or 4 weeks, and I couldn't stop it. And I don't know. So I don't know what it is. It's a good story. Hopefully, it's a good weird story. And the model, the book that it's based on largely, is a book called The Invention of Morel by an Argentinian writer called Cazares. So it's a kind of Robert Louis Stevenson yarn as well, the book.
Not quite sure what it was. I think you've told one interviewer that it looks like a horrible ball of shit. Do you still agree with that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I feel very ambivalent about this whole thing. I mean, it's not something I feel happy. It feels incredibly painfully intimate. And there's some things in there in a kind of code which I'd rather people didn't read.
That was Simon Critchley, author of Memory Theatre, speaking to Monocle's Emma Nelson on Monday's edition of Midori House. You're listening to The Curator with me, Gillian DeBias. The history of African-American cinema is one of the richest threads of 20th century cinema. Historians have attempted to trace that narrative by amassing a collection of black film posters. Well, that remarkable collection has been brought together for the very first time and published in a new book, Separate Cinema, for the First 100 Years of Black Poster Art. Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, spoke to the man behind the book and the collection, John Duke Kish.
The role of the black actor had been so minimal, they'd been so marginalized in Hollywood films, that by the time Birth of a Nation came out, the racist masterpiece by D.W. Griffith, the director, blacks objected for the racism, and they decided that it was time to boycott that sensibility of filmmaking. And they took it upon themselves to find a couple of directors, a couple of producers, a couple of actors that would actually forward the race in the names of Oscar Micheaux, Noble Johnson, William Foster. They redressed the balance, and they created their own aesthetic in film. Over the course of the past 100 years, there has been a separate cinema, something that kind of paralleled the Hollywood system and the regular system that marginalized blacks, in something that made African Americans, as well as blacks in general across the globe, a little bit more proud of their accomplishments. And that separate cinema were films that we discuss and illustrate in the book that kind of represents more about the black contribution to the history of cinema.
Now, tell me, one of the early chapters deals with Norman films. And is this a good example of the kind of thing you're talking about? Although here, interesting, the character, I believe Richard Norman was a white person who kind of supported this kind of fledgling industry with a series of several films, all kind of black casts.
That's correct. Norman was white. He was one of the few sympathetic studio owners that it's about film. It's about, you know, it's about storytelling. It's not just about placing a black man in the role of a driver or a woman in the role of a mammy. It's not that at all.
And tell me, for you, the fascination with collecting, because the story is told through the film posters dating, you know, from the early days of cinema right up through to the 60s and beyond. Just tell me, how did you get involved with collecting these posters, and how quickly did you realize that they were such an amazing social history?
Well, it started when I was in college, and I was a graphics major in school, and a friend had given me a poster that had musical connotations, as well as beautiful graphics. And I just loved it. it opened up my eyes to advertising, number one, as well as great, great design work. That just led to my looking for more posters of this variety. And after many years out of school, putting this stuff on my wall in my photo studio, people would comment and they would tell me things about some of the black actors that I had no idea the history behind and the historic content, the historic nature of which became my obsession. At one point, someone came into the studio and said, "Do you know about who these people are and all that?" And I said, "No." They said, "You better learn your history." And I did. And since the early 1980s, I've been trying to put a storyline to all of this that makes sense both visually and historically.
And tell me, some of those early stars, you have in the book some posters for the first black actor to become a millionaire from Hollywood.
That would be, Stephen Fetchett, of course.
And who was he?
He was a racist character that Hollywood created, this racist Stephen Fetchett, wide-eyed buffoon, who in fact was the first black millionaire there in Hollywood. But he took on all of these roles, which were comic and belittling, and took it to the bank. America soon tired of that, and he, later on in his life, he renounced those early days in Hollywood that did nothing to advance the cause of the black actor or the pride of the black actor. So, Stephen Fetchett, number one. But then, things went on to Paul Robeson, who was the chief actor who brought the pride of African-American and the blacks in general as actors and actresses.
What began to challenge that racism? Was it the advent of the Second World War, or was it not until the Civil Rights Movement that there was real change in the kinds of roles and therefore the kinds of cinema posters that we began to see?
Well, I think it's a little bit of all of that. Certainly after Birth of a Nation, people objected to the racist message there. And that was 1915. But sure, you mentioned the turn of after the Second World War. Yes, that would, 1949, 1950, they were the first years in which Hollywood really took the black actor and focused on the problems that black America was having. No longer just relegating them to the margins, it was about a black problem. Home of the Brave, which was about a black GI. Pinky, which was about a woman passing for white. Lost Boundaries, Intruder in the Dust. Those are all kind of what they call problem pictures. And that's from the, late 40s, early 50s, where the storylines really changed to be more about blacks and the problems that blacks faced. Of course, that extends into blaxploitation in the 1970s, when finally America and their black population stood up to the man, demanded their rights. They were given free rein in Hollywood for blaxploitation in the early 70s. It was great. It was great stuff.
That was John Duke Kish, whose book Separate Cinema, The First 100 Years of Black Poster Art is out now. That's nearly all for this week's edition of The Curator, but we still have time for one of the monologues from the past week. Monocle's Thomas Lewis reflects now on the uneasy peace in the United Kingdom following last week's historic referendum on Scottish independence.
It was a chilly Friday evening in Glasgow, and camped out in the doorway of a department store in the fading sunlight were a band of street musicians belting out a rather grungy rendition of the Benny King classic Stand By Me. This could have been an unofficial campaign anthem for the Better Together campaign, the group lobbying against Scotland's independence from the United Kingdom, whose headquarters were set deep inside a rather unglamorous shopping centre just across the street and where I'd just come from. The offices were busy, phone numbers across the country were being cold-called, and the campaign's leader, Alistair Darling, Britain's former Chancellor of the Exchequer, had just left the premises, leaving a hive of activity in his wake. The question on the ballot paper in Scotland's referendum, should Scotland be an independent country, set in motion a conversation unprecedented in recent British history. In bus stops and coffee shops, in classrooms and staff rooms across the country, people talked about and questioned and grappled with the idea of the kind of country their country should be. This referendum was being held in a time of peace, and this was a question born out of a democratic process, not of the tensions or violence nationalism in its conventional form usually brings. As one city councillor in Glasgow told me, we have accomplished a hugely democratic debate on a hugely divisive subject without a scratch on the furniture. Well, for the rest of the UK, the varnish on the furniture did get a bit of a scuff in the last 2 weeks of the campaign. Whereas Scotland had debated independence for 2 years or so, the rest of the UK only woke up to the prospect with 2 weeks to go before polling day, leaving little room above the clamour for the nuance and the detail that had been the hallmark of the conversation north of the border. The constitutional future of the UK, it seems, is all to play for. Politics, one London-based newspaper wrote in the lead-up to the vote, can't always be like this. Well, maybe not. But let's hope that as the familiar grind of politics as we knew it here in the UK returns, the example set by the record 85% of voters who turned out to take part in the referendum doesn't fade too. For all there's a lot of fears, one Scottish actress told me in the lead up to the vote, there's a lot of hopes as well. Well, let's hope they aren't smothered as British politics tries to resume its normal service. For Monocle, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Well, that is all we've got time for on this week's edition of The Curator. The show was produced by Sam Impey, and I'm Gillian DeBias. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of programmes here on Monocle 24. And now, to play us out of this episode, here's a track from this week's Midori House session. I give you Willie Watson and his track, Keep It Clean. Thanks for listening.
I ran to the river, I couldn't get across. Jumped on your papa cause I thought he was a horse now. Ride him over, give him a Coca-Cola, lemon soda, sauce of ice cream, take soap and water, for to keep it clean. Up she jumped, down she fell, her mouth flew open like a mussel shell. Now, ride her over, give her Coca-Cola, lemon soda, sauce of ice cream, take soap and water, to keep it clean. If you want to get to heaven when you D-I-E, you got to put on your collar and your T.I.E. now. Ride him over, give him a Coca-Cola, lemon soda, sauce with ice cream, take soap and water, for to keep it clean. If you wanna get the rabbit out, the L.O.G., you got to put on a stump like a D.O.G. now. Ride him over, give him a Coca-Cola, lemon soda, sauce of ice cream, take soap and water, for to keep it clean. So your sister was a teddy, your daddy was a bear. Put that muzzin' on your mama cause she had bad hair. Now, ride her over, give her Coca-Cola, lemon soda, sauce of ice cream, take soap and water, for to keep it clean. So run here, doctor, run here fast. Tell me what's the matter with her, yes, yes, yes. Now, ride her over, give her Coca-Cola, lemon soda, sauce of ice cream, take soap and water, for to keep it clean. Take soap and water, for to keep it clean.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.